Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." So he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus shall you say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male servants, female slaves. I've sent to my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight." And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two camps, thinking, "If Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape." And Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred, that I may do you good,' I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have sworn to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, 'I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.'" So he stayed there that night, and from what he had with him, he took a present for his brother Esau: 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their calves, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. These he handed over to his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, "Pass on ahead of me and put a space between drove and drove." He instructed the first, "When Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, 'To whom do you belong, and where are you going, and whose are these ahead of you?' then you shall say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. They are a present sent to my lord Esau, and moreover, he's behind us.'" He likewise instructed the second and the third and all who followed the droves, "You shall say the same thing to Esau when you find him, and you shall say, 'Moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us.' For he thought, 'I may appease him with a present that goes ahead of me, and afterward I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me.' So the present passed on ahead of him, and he himself stayed that night in the camp. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female slaves, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day has broken." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." The sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of the thigh. This is a story about transitions. It's all about transitions. There's first of all the crossing of the river Jabbok, which marks Jacob's return to the promised land. Now, we've skipped a number of chapters in the narrative of Genesis. I may simply fill in this hole by saying that Jacob has been away from the promised land for more than 2 decades, a long time. Now he is about to re-enter the country. More than that, Jacob is about to meet his brother Esau. Jacob and Esau did not have a good relationship at all. In fact, at one point, Esau was minded to kill his brother because he had stolen his birthright. Now, Jacob had every right to be nervous about this rendezvous. But this was also a time of transition because Jacob, the eponymous ancestor of Israel, in fact, you will find the name Jacob to become a synonym for the children of Israel at times in the Old Testament. The eponymous ancestor of the nation receives a new name, the national name, Israel. This is a truly historic moment when he was left alone at the ford of the river, wrestling with a mysterious person until the breaking of day. I want you to remember that many, many years after the accounts narrated in Genesis chapter 32, Jacob was asked by Pharaoh of Egypt, "How old are you?" Apparently, he saw this man walking on a stick into his palace, into his throne room, and he couldn't help but realize he must be very old. So, "How old are you, Jacob?" Jacob's reply was this. This is Genesis 47, verse 9. "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." Few and evil. Okay, I can understand few because all is relative. From our perspective, 130 years is a very, very long life. Few people get that old. But the patriarchs lived longer. God simply preserved them. But then he says, few and evil. This is how Jacob characterizes the years of his life. It was an evil time. This is how Jacob summarizes the days of his life. And when you read the Jacob cycle, the chapters that concern the life of Jacob, you will soon learn why he would say this. Jacob grew up as the exact opposite of his brother Esau. Genesis 25:27 describes him as a quiet person living in tents. His brother Esau, on the other hand, was the exact opposite. He was a skillful hunter, the outdoors kind of guy. In other words, a real Oregonian. And when the kids would say, "Well, let's go out and kill us a few animals," Jacob would say, "I'd rather stay home and read encyclopedias," which is, of course, an anachronism. But if you think that because he is described as a quiet person, living in tents, cooking at home, doing little things around the tent, if you think that Jacob was a nice fellow, nice guy, and a pleasant person to be around, you couldn't be further from the truth. His character was already revealed at his birth, when he grabbed the heel of his brother Esau, who happened to enter the stage of this world before him. And by grabbing his heel, the reader is to understand that he was to be a deceiver. This earned him the name Yaakov. Yaakov in Hebrew means the one who grabs the heel. And in plain English, this means the deceiver, the supplanter. Now, once this name was assigned to Jacob, he had to live up to it. And I suppose that we are by no means exaggerating when we say that he lived up to the expectation, even beyond our wildest expectation. Let me give you a few snapshots. As a young man, he ruthlessly took advantage of the weakness of his brother. He made him sign over his birthright for a pot of soup. You get the picture. It's like the proverbial con artist who says to you, "Well, just sign it, the dotted line. It's all right." And you sign over your life without even knowing it. That's what he did to his brother. When his brother Esau was to receive the patriarchal blessing and become the leader of this clan of people of God, he duped his own father, his blind father, about his true identity. He was play-acting, he was sounding and trying to appear like Esau, his brother, to inherit his blessing from his own father. So he cheated his brother a second time. And I want you to remember that Jacob grew up in a home in which the stories of Abraham and Isaac, his father, were current from his birth. He had heard about the God of creation. He had heard about the God of the fathers every day. So it was not only that he consciously deceived his own father about this pivotal blessing, but he also was in the business of manipulating God. Surely Jacob, like any of the believers in those days, knew that when all is said and done, God is the one who blesses. And he thinks that you can trick God into blessing you somehow, manipulate God. Maybe these were not thoughts that consciously occurred to him, but this is how he acts, and it says something about his heart, where he is with God and his neighbor. Now, these incidents show him to be a conniving character. Yeah, he was Jacob, the deceiver. And God chose Jacob and not Esau. And he put him through a school of discipline to educate him in his ways. And this is the reason now why Jacob said before Pharaoh, "Few and evil have the days of the years of my pilgrimage been." God ground him down. Bit by bit, he broke him down until he finally broke indeed. So, what happened to Jacob? Let us push this story a little bit further till we reach the point in our text. Well, first of all, he had to flee from his angry brother whose right he had stolen. And then he ended up under the tutelage of a certain Laban. Laban himself being an accomplished con artist and swindler, actually taught him a lesson or two about taking advantage of other people, and in this sense gave him a good taste of his own medicine. We know, of course, that Laban was the father of Leah and Rebekah, and that Laban gave these two daughters of his to Jacob as wives. And this was done in a true tale of mystery and imagination. Now, this is what he did, Laban, that is. Laban made Jacob serve for the younger of the two, Rebekah, for no less than 7 years. Now, I can tell you this, that was not custom in those days to make someone a slave or a servant for 7 years for the daughter. And you got to remember, Laban was then to be the father-in-law of this son-in-law of his, and he made him slave away for 7 years for his daughter Rebekah. And if you think about the person of Laban, he is not the kind of guy that you want to sit down with at a table and bargain over so much as a pair of socks. He's just a hard-nosed individual, and he takes advantage of people. And Jacob was delivered into his hand. And make no mistake about it, God did this. God was in this too. God was also there, and in the final analysis, responsible for the next twist in this narrative. Because at the end of the 7 years, there was a wedding and there was a wife. It just wasn't Rebecca. It was Leah, the older of the two sisters. Laban's dry comment about this high-handed change of plan was, "It is not customary in this part of the world to prefer the younger over the older." The end of the matter was that Jacob had to serve another 7 years for Rebekah. During that time, Laban felt entitled to change his wages whenever he wanted to, and guess what? These adjustments were never in Jacob's favor. They always placed roadblocks in his way. They made life difficult for him, and surely he had every right to become bitter if that is what he chose. So he served Laban for a total of about 2 decades, probably a few years longer even than that, in Haran. And Laban made life difficult for him. But now think about his two wives. Leah and Rebecca were sisters, and they were hopelessly engaged in all-out war against each other, over the husband, over blessings, over it was a race over who has more children, who has the bigger family between the two. And so you get the picture of this being a household in which there was constant strife, there was contention in that tent of Jacob, and sometimes even screaming. Jacob was in the middle of all of this. And if I ask you whether you would like to be in his skin only for 1 year, what would you say? I do not want to be walking in his track. Certainly not. But these were his family troubles, and he wouldn't find rest in his own tent. These long years of fighting within and being taken advantage of without by his father or by his father-in-law Laban, they took a toll on Jacob. They wore him down, and in this process, God broke his heart. He broke him down bit by bit. He chipped away at him. Now, Jacob had always been a slow learner in things pertaining to God, but because God was his teacher, he eventually made progress. And so now when you come to Genesis chapter 32, you encounter quite a different Jacob. Now his brother Esau is approaching with an entourage of 400 fighting men. Obviously, Jacob is nervous. And so he makes preparations. He divides up his company into two camps and sends them ahead of him with gifts to pacify him if this sort of diplomacy should be needed. And you wonder, has this man learned anything at all? Or has he remained unchanged? Because it does look as though he is still the conniving, calculating kind of character. Although you do have to cut him a little bit of slack here. I think this could also be a sign of contrition for what he had done to his brother so many years ago. However this may be, at the center of all these preparations for this encounter with his brother, you hear Jacob's prayer. Jacob's prayer is at the heart of this text, and it is here where you can see the grace of God working in this man's heart. This is what I want you to take home today, and I don't want you to forget it, ever. There are two prayers in the Jacob cycle, two prayers recorded of Jacob, and they are placed at critical junctions in his pilgrimage. The first prayer that he prayed, and that is recorded in the Bible, is found in Genesis chapter 28. This was the time when he left Canaan. He fled from his brother after he had stolen his birthright. And so he became an exile. At that point, when he left Canaan, he prayed the following prayer. Let me read this to you so that you get the drift. This is Genesis 28, verse 20. Jacob made a vow saying, "If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, for this is what God had promised him, then the Lord shall be my God." Do you hear what he's saying? This is his prayer in a nutshell. Lord, if you bless me, then I will acknowledge you. He is saying, if you prove your worth to me, then I will acknowledge you. God has to prove his worth to Jacob before he gives him his due, before he worships him and acknowledges him. And he is sounding like a man who argues from a position of strength. Isn't this what he is saying? His words are, "Well, I'm going to sit back and see what you got, God. I'm going to see what you can do for me. And if I am pleased to see what you do, well, then I will worship you." He is a very, very selfish, self-centered, egotistic individual. A spoiled brat. The second prayer recorded in the Jacob cycle is at another very critical junction, because it is found in Genesis chapter 32 when Jacob is just about to re-enter the land of promise that he had left for so many years. And his prayer in Genesis 32 is what he says. "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred that I may do you good,' I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, 'I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.'" This prayer, as opposed to the earlier one, is a totally different ballgame. In the first prayer, God had to show his worth to Jacob. This is what he says here. If we are talking worth, Lord, then I will say this: I am unworthy. I am unworthy even of the least of the blessings that you have granted, and you've given me so much. But I'm unworthy of these things. I know it. And you've been faithful, and your steadfast love has surrounded me like an army and protected and preserved me, and I didn't deserve it. I know it. And Jacob adds to this, "I am saying these words and I'm asking for this deliverance only because you have said that you would bless me." Notice that this phrase, "you have said," shows twice in this brief prayer of Jacob. He shows himself to be a man of faith. Why? Because he clings to the word of God. "You have said, Lord." He clings to the promise of God and so shows himself to be a man of faith. God heard these words of Jacob. He heard them and he put them to the test. In the middle of the night, when Jacob is the only person left on the eastern bank of the river, there appears a mysterious person. And he takes a hold of Jacob and he wrestles him to the ground. And then there is a wrestling match all through the night. Jacob knows who this man is. He is fighting with God. He is fighting with God. This is a wrestling match that Jacob could never win. But he did win the fight. God acknowledges it.